Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for the last time for Roger McDonough of KCPW. Today on the show, Facebook chooses New Mexico over West Jordan for the site of its new data center. Congressman Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz work to pass their public lands initiative. Draft plans for a state water management plan, might not be released to the public, and the number of Mormons who identify as Republicans drops nationwide. Those and other topics on the show today. Joining me this morning, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington, D.C. Bureau reporter Thomas Burr is on the phone. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Ben.
And in the studio, we have environment reporter Emma Penrod. Welcome, Emma.
Good morning.
Government reporter Robert Gerke is with us also. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And finally, from Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is in with us. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. What caught your attention from this past week's news? Put your comments and questions in the comments section at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Tommy Burr, let's start with some news out of Washington. Congressman Jason Chaffetz said there's still time to pass the Public Lands Initiative before Congress adjourns. What's at stake and what progress has that proposal made?
So it's at the beginning of the process, which isn't necessarily good, given that Congress is really only in session for this next coming week and the week after before they adjourn for until after Election Day. And it's only so far had one, subcommittee hearing here in Washington. So now they've still got to, do a markup, which they, change and tweak the bill, vote it out of committee, and then take it to the House. And then at some point, they've got to take it to the Senate. And if there are differences in the bills, they've got to have a conference committee. And then they can send it to the president. But here's the thing. No real time left in the real session. Congressman Chaffetz and Bishop say, hey, look, there's a long lame duck session, which is after the election, where they think they can still get it done. But chances of it getting out of the Senate are pretty tough for the Public Lands Initiative. And then, I have a hard time believing that President Obama would sign the bill. So we're looking, at the end of the day, there's likely going to be a veto if it reaches the president's desk. But again, the congressmen are optimistic at the moment.
What are the major differences between the Public Lands Initiative and what we would expect from a monument designation?
There's quite a big difference. The monument designation would be, 1.8 million acres and cover, a lot of the areas the environmental groups and tribal leaders have asked to be protected, whereas the Public Lands Initiative does some switching around with lands. The CITLA, the public lands or public schools properties in the southern part of the state are switched around with some federal lands. There's areas opened up for some development. There are some protections, of course. That's what the Bishop tried to get, some protections for the area down there, the Bear Seas region. But it's a lot smaller than what a monument, the proposed monument designation would be.
You mentioned that a subcommittee had taken up the bill. What was the temperature in the room in that subcommittee?
It's obviously very divided between Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans brought in witnesses, of course, who were very supportive of the Public Lands Initiative. They did invite the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, which both opposed the bill. And Democrats were very critical of this process, the Public Lands Initiative, and the end-all goal. They think that Bishop has to actually help, the oil and gas industry.
You said that the bill, if it passes the House, has an uphill battle in the Senate. On that note, you also wrote that Senators Hatch and Lee are looking to preemptively exempt Utah from the Antiquities Act. What's going on there?
So this is just another tact, right? They're trying all cylinders right now to stop a monument. So there's public lands initiatives starting in the House. And then Hatch and Lee introduced legislation that would say the president couldn't designate any monument in Utah. That one's probably even more of a message bill coming this late. There hasn't been legislation like that that's passed for 50 years. Last time they exempted Wyoming from the Antiquities Act, but again, for half a century, other legislation to exempt other parts, states or whole states hasn't gone anywhere.
So with Wyoming being exempted, why not Utah? Why was Wyoming able to get that exemption?
I actually don't know the history there, but I know, it was something controversial that happened, I'm sure, back then, and they push through the legislation in a much more friendly House and Senate. I believe there's also some protection for Alaska as well against some Antiquities Act movements. But again, environmental groups are saying this move by Hatch and Lee is a quote, last-ditch Hail Mary, that they're just trying to do everything they can to stop the monument.
If that effort were to be successful, would the exemption be temporary, or would any future president, including Republican presidents, be barred from designating monuments in the state?
Yeah, it's not just aimed at President Obama. It's any president. And, of course, legislation is only as permanent as Congress wants it to be. So there could be, if Democrats were to take the Senate and the House in the coming years, they could repeal it as well. So it's just there for as long as... if they were to pass it for as long as they want it.
A quick reminder to listeners, you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-8255. Tommy, before we lose you, let's talk a little about Mormon politics. Why are fewer members of the LDS Church identifying as Republicans?
This is interesting. So the Pew Research Center did a study. They interviewed 8,000 Americans looking at voter identification along the lines of race and gender and religion and socioeconomic status. And in this study, it's really interesting to note that they did the same thing in 2012, and you had more than 60% of Mormons across the country who said they were Republicans. This year, it's 48%. So it's dropped significantly. Even those who say they lean Republican or are Republican, that's dropped at least about 10 points as well. So political scientists and those who study these things chalk that up to what they call there are two factors, the Romney factor and the Trump factor. In 2012, you had Mormons who were so very excited to have a Mormon as a heading up a major party ticket. And in this year, you have Mormons who were not necessarily super excited about Donald Trump's nomination and are not necessarily wanting to align with the party of Trump.
As you mentioned, Mormons are typically seen as a fairly reliable GOP voting bloc. But now with fewer than half saying they're self-identifying as Republicans, what does that mean for the political spectrum?
So that's the other part of the poll that showed. While there are those who are saying they're not identifying as Republicans, they're not switching over to the Democratic column. They're just kind of staying in that wiggle room of being an independent. So you're not necessarily, this isn't helping Democrats, although you could argue that fewer Republicans and more independents could mean they could swing to vote for some Democrats. But in the end, it's not like the Democrats or the Republicans' losses, the Democrats win. It's the independents who are just wanting to kind of wait this one out, apparently.
With the Romney effect and the Trump effect, does it appear that this drop is a drop, or is this a stabilization after a period of upswing?
If you look at the trend, they've been polling on this since 1994, and if you look at the trend, it does ebb and flow quite often. It can be 80%, it can be 60%, 48%. It just kind of goes around that. But you can see in some form a trend line of fewer Mormons identifying themselves as Republicans. Now, let's not forget, it's still a major portion of Mormons who consider themselves Republicans, but it is declining ever so slightly over time. And you'll see that with the younger crowd. Some millennials in that kind of age area are not necessarily aligning with either party.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Tommy. That's Salt Lake Tribune, Washington, D.C. Bureau reporter Tommy Burr. Tommy, thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Ben.
George Pyle, editorial writer for the Tribune. Pew looked at Mormon politics nationally. Are we seeing any shifts within LDS Republicans here in the state?
Well, as we've talked about, Donald Trump is not the family values Republican that a lot of Mormons would prefer to support. In the caucus primary back in March, he came in a distant third, even after actually coming to the state and having a pretty well-attended and well opposed rally downtown. People in Republicans in Utah were more in the Cruz Rubio category than they were for Donald Trump. So he alienates a lot of people with his lifestyle, with the way he talks, with the anti-Muslim comments he makes, and Mormons remember a time when they were the excluded religious minority, literally chased out of other states. And so there's some sympathy there for religious groups that are being put upon. In Utah, there's been talk about, well, maybe Utah's in play, maybe the Democrats could actually take it for the first time since Lyndon Johnson. The polls now show that's not very likely, but there are Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, other places where there are conservative Republican family values, Mormon Republicans. They are states that might where that vote might make a difference. Now, some of this is before my time, but my understanding is that you had a lot more Mormon Democrats, you know, a century ago. I mean, up through Harry Truman, they voted for him. It was in the 60s that that Mormons started to leave the Democratic Party as it became seen by many people as the radical left feminist free love party, and they didn't want anything to do with that. And that's when the Mormon idea shifted more to the Republicans and has pretty much stayed there ever since.
So if you're a state GOP leader, do these numbers faze you at all?
Well, I think they always have to be concerned with any shift. You always want somebody that you can count on so that those voters turn out, and then you can spend your resources on voters that might be kind of on the brink one way or another. You know, the more reliable voters you have that all you have to do is turn them out, the easier it is for any party to win an election. Any time you have to fight for more voters, it's time for you to stop and consider what you might have to do.
I think it's entirely possible, too, that there's another factor here that we haven't really discussed, and that is that people generally don't like politics right now, and they don't necessarily like either party. It's a pox on both their houses,
yeah.
Right? And so, you know, you don't like Democrats, you don't like Republicans, I'm going to identify as an independent, or I'm going to identify as a third party or something like that. And there's also been this sort of vein in Mormonism, and in Western Mormonism in particular, this sort of independence, independent ideal as well. So they envision themselves as the rugged individualist and the independents. And so identifying with a party or not identifying with a party, I think, is sort of a natural place for them to come back to after the Romney surge, after the Reagan surges in the 80s. And so I don't think you read too much into this. And I think for the long-term ramifications are probably pretty slim because, as George and Tommy both mentioned, they're not going to from identifying as Republicans to identifying as Democrats. They're going from identifying Republicans as identifying as independents, but they probably still vote Republican at the end of the day.
Yeah, and that's true, across all religious groups and across, especially with younger people, more and more people are identifying as unaffiliated or independent and not choosing up sides with either party. Mormons may be, something that we notice around here and maybe kind of leading that curve, but it's not that far off of everybody.
Mm-hmm. And that was government reporter Robert Gerke chiming in. From a strategy perspective, if you're Democrats in Utah, are you looking for Mormons to become Democrats in large number or simply leave the Republican Party and be independent?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think you've got to kind of – it's a 12-step program that the Democrats need to run here, I think. And so they've got to bring them, through the phases they're not going to wake up one morning and say, oh, well, I was a Republican, but now I'm going to vote for Democrats. They've been trying with sort of moderate success to make this appeal to Democrats or to Mormons, trying to stress that we have family values, we have we value education, we value these issues that Mormons care about, we're good on immigration, that sort of thing. We're good on air quality. That's one that they hit pretty hard with Mormon moms especially, but it's not paying off all that well. I mean, they're going to keep at it, right? And because at the end of the day, with the sizable majorities that you've got in this state of Mormon voters, and the frequency with which they turn out, you've really got to make that appeal. But it's the success that they've had so far has been marginal, I guess you'd say.
And George, before we go to break, I want to get your take on Senator Hatch and Senator Lee's exemption plan from the Antiquities Act.
Yeah, I don't see how that has any chance of passing. I mean, Tommy's more plugged into it certainly than I am. But the it's one of those things they're trying to show the flag back home, say, you know, we're standing up for Utah, and the whole idea that with you know, the state suing to get all these millions of acres of land returned, which is one of the biggest false words used in politics. It never belonged to Utah in the first place. It belonged to the Indians, belonged to Mexico, it belonged to, and now it belongs to the United States of America. They keep talking about this like it's Utah's land. It's not Utah's land. It belongs to the federal government, and they're not going to get it back. It's not going to happen, but they can get a lot of attention and draw a lot of campaign contributions claiming they're going to.
Just real briefly, I think that they also need to be able to go back home and tell voters that they did everything they possibly could to try to block this monument once the monument's already
done. Yeah, no, they don't want it to be their fault, and it won't be.
They want to be able to say, well, look, we tried, we did everything we could, but we got a monument, so deal with it. And so I think that's what both of these pieces of legislation are. And as Tommy mentioned, with just, you know, a couple weeks left of work time before the end of this end of the session, and really before the end of Obama's term, where he's likely going to, you know, create that monument if the bills don't pass, then they're really up against the deadline that it's almost impossible to get through.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take a quick break. Ahead on the show, we'll be talking about Utah's draft water management plan. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough, and joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Emma Penrod and Robert Gerke, and by editorial writer George Pyle. We're digging into this past week's news, and you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Emma Penrod, you wrote this week about a draft plan for the state water management. Who's putting that plan together, and what kind of recommendations does it call for?
Okay, so in 2013, the governor appointed a advisory team, a task force that was various, you know, there were environmental interests, industry interests, researchers, you know, water managers, and they were tasked with creating a plan for a guiding document that could offer some insight into how Utah to manage its water for the next 50 years or so. The idea was that these guys were going to both provide their own input and take input from various other public sources. They were going to get an idea for what Utahns want to see done with their water, and they were going to offer recommendations for how that could be done. It isn't necessarily a, you know, like definitive, this is going to happen kind of a thing. It was just like a book of advice and positions that were recommended to the governor.
Now, you were able to see a copy of this plan, but I understand the drafters didn't necessarily intend for it to be made public. What was the discussion there?
Yeah, so they met on Tuesday morning, the advisory team did, and while they were there, there was one item of business, which was to discuss the draft of this plan. And the draft document, which had been printed out and had a large notice on the front saying that it was not for public, not to be distributed to the public, was then handed out to members of the advisory team. And they were instructed to ensure that it was not distributed to the public. They were told, however, that they were to solicit public feedback on what should be included in the document. And they were told that they could show the document to members of the public, but just not distribute it.
So the idea being there that the public could see it but not keep a copy for themselves and take home with them.
That appeared to be the case.
Inside the draft plan itself, I understand there were some recommendations on the Lake Powell Pipeline, the Bear River Project. Could you talk to us about some of the arguments around those projects?
Well, I guess with those two projects, there's one of them, maybe the controversial aspects of this document is that the advisory team or the document included as what they called a baseline assumption, the assumption that large regional water projects would be required. They didn't necessarily go into detailing why they would be required because they just said, we've agreed they're required, and that's just going to be an assumption built into this document. on other pages and other parts of the report, it cites, you know, water rights issues and conflict between states over allocations from the Colorado River, suggesting that the Lake Powell pipeline must be built to avoid having downstream states claim Utah's allocation. And it also does cite as well, you know, saying we're going to need the water from these projects in the future. But it doesn't really go into a lot of detail as far as justifying either of those projects. It just says they're needed and recommends that the governor move forward with making sure that they are pursued and built.
What would be the next steps for this plan, or where does it go from here after this draft discussion?
The governor's office did say after the meeting that the governor supports having this document released to the public. It's not clear how that's going to shake out. The co-chairs I've talked with since say that they will, that they are encouraged by the governor's support for that, and that it appears to be their intent that all future drafts be made public. The idea then is that they are going to get feedback on this draft from members of the advisory team, and they'll say whether they want this changed or that changed. The document will be revised. There will, I think, be another draft issued that maybe will have more input, and then a final draft, once it is finished, will be sent to the governor's office for his consideration.
George Pyle, the Tribune had an editorial about this yesterday or the day before. I'm losing track of time.
Yeah, it's easy to do when everything's online now and exactly. In print later.
As I understand, the editorial talked about how a lot of this plan looks like it's the same kind of thing we've heard before.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder why you want to keep it secret if there's nothing new in it. The assumption that they're going to have a Lake Powell pipeline, talk about pipe dreams, and the dam the Bear River, and we don't have the water. I mean, but even without severe climate change, the idea that all that water is going to be there for us to pipe around is really just not supported by any science, by any logic. They're already talking about not only not having pipelines from Lake Powell, they're talking about draining Lake Powell, letting the water go down to Lake Mead and distributing it from there. The Great Salt Lake is becoming the Great Salt Puddle. I mean, somebody wrote us a letter, the editor the other day said we should change the state motto to life evaporated. They were talking about breaching the causeway that goes through the lake because of the problems with salinity and everything. And now, you know, after bugging the railroad for years to say, oh, we need to put a breach in the causeway, they were saying, no, wait, stop. We've decided that there's so little water going into the lake that maybe that's not such a good idea after all. So the railroad is saying, well, make up your minds. So again, it's like, you know, why keep this secret if you're not going to do anything different? And I guess maybe that's what they don't want us to know, is that they're not interested in doing anything different. They're not interested in getting away from these ridiculous plans to move around, to spend billions of dollars to move around water we don't have.
Mm-hmm. Emma, you wrote about the causeway discussion on the Great Salt Puddle, as George said. The causeway divides the lake into two sections, and originally water was intended to flow between the two sections, but that's no longer happening, correct?
Yeah, very, very originally the causeway was a bridge that ultimately had to be filled in, but there were culverts underneath the causeway that was supposed to allow the water to circulate from one side to the other. But along the way, these culverts, they kind of they sank into the lake bed. About 20 feet is what I'm told. And they became impassable and also unstable for the tracks going over the top. So they were filled in. And as a mitigation for that, the railroad promised that it would open up a breach in the causeway elsewhere and build a bridge across it to allow the water to continue to flow between two sides now that they've filled in those culverts. Those were filled, I was told, beginning 2011.
So about 5 or so years that the water from one side has been cut off from the other side.
There is another opening. There's already one breach that was opened in the 80s, I understand, during the flooding. But so it's not completely cut off, but the flow isn't the greatest, is my understanding.
So what's been the effect on the lake due to that causeway splitting it?
Well, most of the water that goes into the lake, it comes in on the south side. There's not as much input on the north side. So the north side has been kind of cut off from all the changes that have gone on that water body. Consequently, the north side is saltier, and it is also, it's actually higher. It has more water in it at the moment. So the concern there is that when you open this breach, because there's not a lot of water to provide a buffer for the changes, that you're going to have all that salt flow into the south side and all the water flow into the north side. And so it's going to get shallower on the south side and saltier on the south side.
So the causeway, of course, is a man-made creation. What are the arguments against breaching it and allowing the water to act in a more natural manner?
Well, the main concerns are, again, the change in the salinity and the change in the water level on the south side. If you increase the salinity, the brine shrimp industry is concerned that a sudden jump in salinity on the south side, which is where most of the brine shrimp is harvested right now, will kill off all of the baby brine shrimp, which I guess the juvenile brine shrimp, that's the stage they're in right now, is they're especially vulnerable this time of year. So they're worried that this would kill a lot of the brine shrimp and decimate the brine shrimp populations, which would contribute to a poor brine shrimp harvest next year. They say they've already had a couple of hard years. Their harvests have been cut short because there isn't enough brine shrimp to go around. It would also affect, you know, there's a very large number of migratory birds that stop over at the Great Salt Lake on their way elsewhere, and they use this as nesting ground, as a feeding ground. And if the brine shrimp are killed off by a sudden fluctuation in salinity, that the birds won't have enough to eat, and that it could, you know, cause some problems there. It's largely a matter of timing in that case. They feel like if the breach were maybe done in December, it could be better. The brine shrimp would be bigger, they'd be more mature, they'd be more able to handle that. The other issue then is the water level. If the breach is opened up, all that water, since the water comes in on the south side, all the water that's sitting there on the south side, not going to the north side because they're not as connected as they naturally would be, will all flow over into the north side. And they'll equal out. And that equalization of the water levels is estimated to cause a 1.5-foot drop on the south side. This has caused concern at the Great Salt Lake State Marina, where the rescue teams that work on the Great Salt Lake are based, because the marina's water is already, at the deepest point, is about 5 feet. And at the mouth, it's only about 3 feet. So only very shallow boats already are able to get out of the marina. And the people familiar with that, the yacht club, they're saying if it gets any more shallow, the emergency boats won't be able to get out. They'll be trapped.
So is this a discussion of when the causeway would be breached or whether it will be breached at all?
It is a discussion of when. In the long run, most people agree that the breach is a good thing, that you don't want the north and the south sides permanently cut off from each other, that there should be that water flow. But they're just saying that if you do it right now with the water level so low and with the water level so unable to absorb the change, that it could cause some significant damage. So the Union Pacific, my understanding, has been in talks this week with state officials to discuss what can be done to delay their operation.
And I'm not particularly familiar with the brine shrimp industry. What are the uses of harvested brine shrimp?
They're used as fish food, for example. Other animals eat brine shrimp, so the brine shrimp are harvested and they're dried and then they're sold to be fed to other animals.
Or sea monkeys at the back, the ad at the back of the comic book. You know, you're too young for that. But you start damming rivers, you start building dams, you start messing up the flow in the lake, and then it's like, okay, we've done a bad thing. We need to do something else. And I used to hang out with this think tank of plant scientists and evolutionary biologists, and their motto was, you can never do only one thing. Anything you do is going to have unintended consequences down the road, and then you think to yourself, well, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe we should reverse that. But then you've reversed a lot of things that have built up over time. So it becomes very difficult to unwind all this stuff.
So, George, if you would offer a prediction, will the breach keep being postponed, or will the Salt Lake be unified once again?
Well, I would imagine that it will happen, but it's been very difficult to forecast the size of the lake. It's impossible to forecast what's going to happen to the lake. After all this time, the lake and its size and its ebbs and flows have been very difficult to predict. And so anything that you do that seems like a really good idea right now, it won't be much longer before you'll think, what were we thinking?
Robert Gerke, I seem to remember if it wasn't the most recent legislative session, in past sessions, some talk about dredging the marina at the Great Salt Lake to account for some of these depth issues. Maybe Emma would be the one to respond, but has there been any more talk about potentially doing that to allow for boats to come in and out?
I think the cost becomes the biggest factor there, but Emma, is there still discussion of that?
Yeah, my understanding is that the state has allocated some $1.5 million to dredging the marina, but it hasn't happened yet. It was supposed to happen. It was delayed, and now the yacht club says they had it re-quoted out. And because of there's a bunch of silting that has gone on at the marina as well. So it's not just the low water level at the marina. The marina has also kind of filled in with silt and debris. And between those two things, they said that the cost for dredging the marina is now much higher than originally anticipated.
Is there a ballpark price tag on that?
They did give me a ballpark price tag on that, but I can't remember offhand what the number was. It was higher than the $1.5 million.
I think it probably is something that they'll ultimately end up doing, just because of the economic and the impacts of that, of the low water levels and, as Emma mentioned, the silting. I mean, it's just a question of coming up with the money, I think, for it. And they'll find a way. They always do.
Okay, great. Well, listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this or anything else in the local news. Call us at 801-355-TALK with your questions. We can take them live on air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Just follow the Behind the Headlines link on the Salt Lake Tribune homepage. We're going to have to take another quick break, but we'll return in a moment. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. I'm joined in studio this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's George Pyle, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. Robert, our final major segment of the day is local politics. You wrote this week that Facebook has announced its plans to build a data center in New Mexico. Is this the end of the line for the West Jordan site that Facebook was negotiating for?
It sure looks like it. The West Jordan folks are saying the deal is dead. They did their best, couldn't get it through. New Mexico came up with a much more generous offer than what West Jordan was providing. West Jordan obviously had some advantages. It's a little bit more metropolitan, at least Salt Lake City. It's adjacency to Salt Lake City. It was kind of a remarkable couple months of negotiation and back and forth. And Facebook, I think it's fair to say, was kind of pitting the two cities against each other to make sure they got the best deal they could. It's fairly remarkable to see a company that has, $360 billion in capital in the bank and coming to town and asking these cities for, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. But there was a strong competition between the two cities. And ultimately, I think it's, the West Jordan mayor, the West Jordan city manager are both basically blaming Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams for coming in and scuttling this deal when it was fairly far down the tracks. Mayor McAdams, of course, is saying, I'll take that. He said it was a bad deal in the first place, and he said it was going to be a bad deal for taxpayers. We were giving up too much to get too little. We were talking about roughly about $200 million in tax breaks in exchange for roughly 130 jobs. The West Jordan folks all said, once you get that in place, there's going to be all these other jobs. There's going to be construction jobs. There's going to be contractors who are going to be working on this thing. There's going to be other tech companies that'll be drawn to it. If that's the case, maybe New Mexico ends up with a pretty good deal. If it's not the case, then maybe they've bought a pig in a poke, so to speak.
There's probably an assumption that in the future, at some point, Facebook will need another data center. Is there any chance that they'll turn their sights on West Jordan once again?
The city manager said that's always a possibility. They liked West Jordan. They had problems, getting the deal done. There's, you know, there was some talk actually during the competition between the two cities that Facebook would just say, okay, we'll do them both because we, you know, their demand for data storage is growing so rapidly. This is actually, I believe, their fifth data center in the country. I mean, they're building these things and they're massive. If you think about these things, that it was six phases, 500,000 square feet of space of just lines and lines of these servers that have, you know, basically are it's a big refrigerator for these servers to keep them cool, but the amount of data they're storing is just mind-boggling. And so, you know, with the expansion that they're going through, it's entirely possible that it's almost certain they'll need another site. It's the question then becomes, you know, does West Jordan, are we already ahead of the game on that, or are we going to have to go back into competing with Boise or other cities? You know, it's hard to say at this point, but yeah, at some point they're going to need more storage space.
You mentioned that West Jordan's mayor has blamed Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams for the deal's failure. McAdams not shying away from that blame. Right. In hindsight, what appears to have killed the deal?
Well, Mayor Rolfe, West Jordan, said that, you know, it's unfortunate that political theatrics kept this from happening. I think ultimately what it came down to was, Mayor McAdams was just not satisfied with the $200 million in incentives for what he saw as 130 jobs in the long run. And it's a remarkable amount of money to give per job. You're talking about, you know, on the order of a couple million bucks per job. And the cost-benefit analysis from Mayor McAdams' standpoint just didn't work out. He pushed aggressively against it. He got the council to vote against it. There was some pressure applied to the state school board that, you know, wasn't really willing to go quite as far as West Jordan wanted to go. And at the, you know, and frankly, New Mexico's deal is there's no question about it, is much more generous than anything that Utah ever had on the table. So, you know, kudos to New Mexico, I guess, for landing this thing. They're very happy about it. They had a unified front, which is something that Utah didn't have. I mean, they had the governor, the congressional delegation, all the local officials were all lined up behind it, and you know, singing from the same playbook. And so it ran into some problems and we weren't able to, you know, weren't able to see it through.
George Pyle, West Jordan talked a lot about how the Facebook project would bring other business interests to the area. Without this data center, would you expect that empty field in West Jordan will stay an empty field?
They're not going to be satisfied until they've paved the Salt Lake Valley, and it's not like it's going to stay empty. Now, there is a question as to it's going to develop. Will it develop more slowly? Will it be more houses? If it's not a data center, will it be a lot of houses? That would happen more slowly, and there's always the argument, yeah, houses pay property taxes, but do they pay enough property taxes to support their needs for streets and sewers and fire departments? The good thing about Facebook data centers is they don't have babies, and so you don't need to build schools. And the Jordan School District is asking for another huge bond issue because they're just packed to the gills in their high schools and middle schools. And so they're trying to build more schools to keep up with the population they have now. And they're pretty much a bedroom community. They rely on their property taxes hard from houses, which don't pay their way. They'd be much happier, even though they were a little reluctant to support this because of the giveaway. Again, they need to broaden their tax base and commercialize it to put in car dealers and server farms and things like that that pay taxes but don't put so much strain on the schools.
They still have – West Jordan still has this huge block that they had already zoned for this Facebook. It's still going to be there. It's still an economic development area. There can be other businesses that come in and get incentives to build there. They still envision it becoming sort of a tech park, you know, and so I think there's going to be other companies that they're going to try to recruit to move into that space.
Okay, something to watch. Robert, you also wrote about some social media back and forth between the House Speaker and Governor Gary Herbert. What happened there?
This one was not on Facebook. This one went down on Twitter. There's been this ongoing sort of dance with Governor Herbert where he's been trying to just desperately avoid endorsing Donald Trump or even saying his name, really. You know, he said he's going to vote for Mike Pence. He's going to vote for the Trump-Pence ticket. But he's refused to talk about either Trump's policies, what he likes or dislikes about his policies, or what his feelings about the candidate. House Speaker Greg Hughes has been a big Trump supporter ever since. Well, he was originally a Marco Rubio supporter, but then he became a Trump supporter after Rubio got out. And he's frustrated, I think, that the governor has been unwilling to kind of come in and, you know, join ranks and you know, support the candidate. There was a letter that went out from the elected officials when Mike Pence came to town, welcoming Mike Pence to town and sort of endorsing the Trump ticket. And Governor Herbert was asked, and he refused to sign that letter. So did Senator Mike Lee, and so did Representative Mia Love. None of those three joined the letter. So I think there's some frustration there. Anyway, the governor the other day was tweeted his opinion on a proposed rule change to high school athletics and the way athletes can be recruited and so forth. And Speaker Hughes, sort of chastised the governor, said, oh, it's a courageous, that's a profile in courage, governor. Thanks for taking such a courageous stand. How do you feel about who should be president? And it was a little bit of a zinger. And then he followed it up saying, you know, he just thinks that the governor's sort of shown a lack of leadership on this issue, that, you know, if his, you know, you take a stand one way or another, but, you know, take a stand. And you know, if you're just trying to go along to get along and not offend anybody, then that's not being a very effective leader. The governor and his staff declined to, respond. They sort of, I guess, are trying to stay out of a fight with the House Speaker. I did hear that they were at a groundbreaking that afternoon, and there was a little bit of an icy tone between the two, that there was not a lot of eye contact, not a lot of camaraderie. So it's, and this is just sort of the latest. There's always tension between the House Speaker and the governor. And you know, we go back to Speaker Lockhart, and she called the governor an inaction figure because he was failing to take leadership roles. I think part of this boils down to the fact that the governor's in an election mode, and he's trying to avoid doing anything that might hurt him electorally. But again, you know, it's his stance on Trump has been interesting to watch, and he actually gets a little testy now when he's asked about it. He says he doesn't want to talk about it anymore. People don't care what he thinks about who should be president. And he's going to avoid the Trump train, so to speak.
Also this week, Hughes participated in a discussion on Wednesday that was critical of the Utah Education Association, the same day the UEA endorsed Governor Herbert in his general election campaign against Democrat Mike Weinholz. How much weight does a UEA endorsement carry with Utah voters?
Well, the endorsement itself probably doesn't swing a lot of votes. I mean, but keep in mind that there's 18,000 members of the UEA, and they go out and they campaign for these candidates that they endorse. It's not just a matter of like saying, you know, we like this candidate, or we, you know, there's money put behind him. But more importantly, I think there's boots on the ground that come with this. And so these teachers and these administrators will be out walking neighborhoods for these candidates, or they'll be encouraged to walk neighborhoods for these candidates. And, you know, when you're running, especially for a legislative seat, that's really important, because there's really only so many ways you can get your message out. And door to door is one of the most effective. And having people out there knocking on those doors for you is a big issue, a big deal. So, you know, the UEA endorsement matters. I don't know. I guess it remains to be seen how much the opposition from President Niederhauser and Speaker Hughes matters. I'm not sure that them sort of rallying opposition to the UEA candidates necessarily is going to be a big factor one way or the other.
George Pyle, the teachers union is typically perceived as left-leaning, or at least not in lockstep with the Republican Party. Any thoughts on why they would choose to endorse Governor Herbert over Mike Weinholz?
Well, yeah, the teachers nationally and have a reputation of being in the Democrats' pocket, or vice versa, depending on how you look at it. In Utah, they're teachers. They can read. They can add. They know who's going to win. And there's no sense in making an enemy out of a sitting governor. Mike Weinholz, the Democrat, is also pushing education. He would actually raise taxes for education, and Governor Herbert would not. He wouldn't raise taxes for anything. But he has fought to keep the legislature from siphoning money away from education and putting it into highways. And every time he makes a speech, a state of the state address, he's big on education. He's big on public education. Every time he finds a spare quarter, he seems to put it toward education. So I think the UEA has reason to believe that by Utah political standards, Gary Herbert is their friend.
And Georgia, Robert mentioned the inaction figure comment by former Speaker Becky Lockhart. It happened at a time that she was believed to be preparing for a governor's race.
Yeah.
Should we read anything into this latest difference of opinion between Hughes and Herbert?
Well, you always have to assume that people who have reached a certain level of politics are spending a lot of their time looking to reach the next level of politics. The fact that Speaker Hughes particularly might be preparing to run for governor or senator and keep his profile up always has to be assumed.
I think it's unlikely you'd see Hughes. I mean, I don't think if Herbert wins this year, I don't think you're going to see him run in 4 years. So I don't think there's going to be a showdown between the two. But it does set an interesting stage for the legislative session coming up.
Yeah.
Well, the hour has flown by. We've spent the time we would have used for underplayed stories. So we'll finish up this edition of Behind the Headlines with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby considers the similarities between the online world and a childhood treehouse.
It could be anything when you were a kid. You know, it'd be a treehouse, a club, a fort. You know, any place where you gathered, where people, kids of like mind, would gather and gossip and talk about horrible stuff they were going to do or had done, where some decorum was required in that, because typically you were in a confined space where somebody didn't like what you were saying, punch you in the face. And that's not so on the internet anymore. You know, the worst kind of person can say anything he wants or she wants.
The thing that happens in this treehouse is a friend of yours has an older brother who comes up and is
not really inclined to participate in group conversation.
And so your friend begins to insult his older brother with a dramatic ending.
Kevin had this treehouse, and we would go up in there and talk about girls and explosions and stuff like that, stuff we wanted to do. And occasionally his older brother, by a number of years, would come up there to smoke and play his guitar. And Kevin hated his older brother, probably for a valid reason.
Right.
But Kevin always underestimated Doug. And one day Kevin was laying into him, and Doug just reached over and pushed him out of the treehouse. He fell. Well, it's got to be at least a dozen feet, landed on his back. And that's how you dealt with chat trolls back then.
Well, it's also the sort of precursor of unfriending somebody.
Yeah, a precursor of unfriending somebody. You have that option in some places, not in others.
This column came to mind because there are reports of a lot of people who are unfriending each other and their friends in this election season. And politics is a place where people's opinions are particularly entrenched. But it's one of the many reasons that you might unfriend somebody, and I guess you just have to kind of shove them out of the virtual treehouse is the idea.
Yeah, you don't engage with them, you know, and you don't give them the attention that they want. But it speaks to a deeper problem, I think, in our society where we are so quick to take offense when someone, I mean, being a victim is probably the...
We love to do it.
We love to do it as a people. Some people get their validation out of being a victim, and so it's always woe is me. Somebody said something bad about me, and that sort of feeds these trolls. You know, they get off on other people's e-pain.
I imagine that for somebody like yourself, who expresses their opinions freely on the internet all the time as a columnist, you have to put up with a lot of people who have opinions that counter to your own. Sometimes the best thing to do, though, is just to push them out of that treehouse, I guess.
Yeah, or don't answer them at all. Don't let them in the treehouse to begin with.
Is it just because it's not worth it, I mean, to have to put up with that sometimes?
Yeah, because if you read it, if somebody sends me an email and calls me a bunch of names for something I wrote about Mormons or whatever, if you read it, it's in your mind. You have to give it time whether you want to or not.
Right.
As opposed to looking at the email and saying, oh, you know, this is going nowhere, click, delete it, and you never engage. Nobody's forcing people to read this stuff, you know, or read what you put online, but they feel the need to be a victim, so they'll come back, you know, paper after paper after paper.
Great.
To tell me what a, you know, horrible person I am.
What's the worst, I'm thinking of this now, what's the worst kind of... comment you've received? How bad has it gotten?
Oh, I get occasional death threats, which I don't take too seriously. But, you know, people will send you pictures that, you know, I've stopped opening attachments and things like that. But mostly it's just a lot of profanity or a lot of sanctimonious rhetoric.
Well, who knew that being a columnist would be as, I guess...
a lightning rod for crazy people. I went from being a cop to a journalist, so I was already thick skin.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions and the Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to my guests today, Tommy Burr from Washington, D.C., and the Tribune's George Pyle, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. Thanks also to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for the last time for Roger McDonough. He'll be back next week. You can hear a rebroadcast of this episode Sunday at 10 o'clock. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great weekend, everybody.